At the Ed Sullivan Theater in Times Square. I'm Michael Goldberg at KXC Studios on the Mississippi River. On today's show, I'm trying to get a handle on the idea of sovereignty. We'll hear from tribal attorney Frank Bebo and visit the Generalissimo of the Island Republic, whose rule was law. But we'll start out today with some thoughts on personal sovereignty, setting your own boundaries, making your own decisions, being able to take responsibility for the consequences, you know, not going around apologizing, but just claiming your space. Don't stay tuned because I told you to. Do it because you want to stay human.
Excuse me, mister, something you should know. I don't look for trouble, but you standing on my toes. Somebody gonna have to move, somebody got to go. Somebody got to move, you standing on my toes. Excuse me, lady, just a word with you. I don't like to bother, but you blocking out my view. Somebody gonna have to move. The only thing to do. Somebody got to move, blocking out my view. Excuse me, mister, I hate to come on square. I'm a peaceful fella, but you in my favorite chair. Somebody gonna have to move, the only thing that's bad. Somebody got to move, sitting in my chair. Somebody gonna have to move.
Okay, so I was crossing 5th Street over by the Central School in Grand Rapids. That downtown is a challenge for pedestrians because it's cut up by Highway 2 and Highway 169. You really have to watch the traffic signals. Just because it's green for cars going the same direction as you doesn't make it safe to cross with all the cars turning. But at this particular intersection on 5th Street, there's no light nor stop sign for the east-west traffic. There's just a painted crosswalk, solid lines on either side. You're supposed to stay inside those lines. Don't go cutting corners. When I got to the corner, there was another human standing on the curb watching the cars go by. I saw a car coming from the east about a half block away and one a little farther coming from the west, so I stepped out into the crosswalk, hand out toward the closer car, and the driver stopped. Once he came to a full stop, I noticed that the person behind me followed me, quickly walked past me to hurry get to the other side.
On the corner of walk and don't walk, somewhere on US 1, I'm back to live in Florida.
Hey, don't get me wrong. I'm not reckless, at least not as a matter of course. Sure, I've crossed against the light once or twice, but only if nobody's coming. But I mean, in the crosswalk, there's a big difference between waiting for permission and exercising my right of way. And not just in the crosswalk. You hear a lot about freedom, but not so much about personal sovereignty. They are related, but not the same thing. You have to have some measure of freedom to exercise your sovereignty. On the playground, I was on that spinning disc, the roundabout, when my playmates grabbed the handles and started running fast as they could, spinning me way too fast, a helpless whirl. I was unable to get or even find any solid ground. That's what personal sovereignty means to me, being able, if I choose, to stand my ground. I think about how much freedom I've had and so many privileges that have allowed me to make choices. Like, after dropping out of college for a couple of years, my girlfriend and I decided to give it another go. We'd go somewhere we'd never been, halfway across the country, because we could. And, of course, obviously the life of a student was better than my job selling health club memberships. My girlfriend worked at the Sterling Memorial Library on the nearby college campus. I spent many happy hours there, expanding my education without the benefit of a curriculum or any relationship to that prestigious institution. I'd find an empty reading room, mullioned windows, a comfortable chair, and just sit and read whatever came to hand. But we decided to quit our jobs and found a school that would take both of us, and we went for it. I was 20 years old. I never did quite grasp, I don't think, how fortunate I was to have the freedom to do that. We're Americans. We take it for granted that if we can do it, we'll go where we want. We just expect to be allowed to do something, go somewhere, so it might as well be what? It might as well be what? How you answer that question is your sovereignty. My girlfriend and I had plenty of freedom, yes, to do, well, what was expected of us, what had been drilled into us all through middle school and high school. No question about it, we had the freedom then, and most of us always do have the freedom to do what everyone else is doing. In fact, some wit said that what they teach you in college is how to think like everybody else. But if you're going to stand your ground, you have to think for yourself. At least, I've always thought so. The native environmental leader, Tom Goldtooth, puts it this way. Sovereignty isn't something you possess. You only have the sovereignty that you exercise. But I think I flatter myself, pretending that this way of looking at things is a reasoned perspective that I've come to, some philosophy that I've found and use and believe in. The truth is, I'm only this way because at the moment of my birth, the sun, the moon, and the ruling planet of Mars were all in the house of Aries. Or if that's not it, it's some incalculable pinball mix of genes and experience, a twisting chain of enzymes and endocrines, random luck, and the trickeries of chance. That's what makes me feel like I ought to be my own captain. Not really the driver, not even the passenger. I'm just the ride. Still, we have to live on this material plane, and to get through our days, we're called on every day to make choices. Even the smallest choices, we often don't know for sure what they'll lead to. And sometimes we have bigger choices to make. It seems to me that the range of possibilities is much wider than we care to admit. Many more options than the first ones that just come to mind. Right at this moment, and always, we have a chance to exercise our own sovereignty, claim our ground.
The ground beneath my feet, I know was made for me. There is no any one place where I belong. My spirit's meant to be free, and soon now everyone will see. Life was made for us to be what we want to be. And if it's your world, it's yours and yours and yours. For us to be what we want to be. And it's your world. It's yours and yours and yours. And what you see,
history unfold before my eyes. My spirit's meant to be free, and so now everyone will be sure right to be whatever you want to be. And this is your world.
I consider myself a patriot, as I may have mentioned many times on this show every year around this time, but I know better than to believe everything I think. So I asked my friend Frank Bebo, a member of the Leech Lake Band and an attorney, how he thinks about patriotism.
The concept of patriotism is usually competing. To be very patriotic means you're standing up for something and you're against something else usually. So that's already kind of a capitalistic, maybe competition kind of a based theory. It's not bringing people together. It's not the whole thing. And so when I look at Independence Day, you know, Independence Day is when all the new boat people to this continent said, hey, we're going to start taking over the rest of the continent, man. You guys get out of the way. So what's patriotic at that point? Standing up for our territory and defending our rights? Or is it being on their side, going out and taking all the territories through manifest destiny? There's a lot of questions about all of that stuff. Fortunately, as we learn more and more stuff, because of the internet and however you want to call it, people being interested, I've come to know that the Chippewa fought in the Civil War, and so did the Potawatomi. And so you had groups of people fighting in other wars that people don't know about. It goes way back. I was born on a military base. My brother and sister were born on military bases. We grew up on military bases for a while. You know, my dad was connected to the federal government for most all of his life and then retired out. So, you know, love of country from that concept, it all seemed like we were all looking for the same thing for everybody. You know, we might disagree on the path or the amount or, you know, maybe who isn't going to be a recipient, but we all had the same interest. And that is more of how I would understand patriotism. What we have now I don't see as patriotism. You know, it's partisan. But everybody likes to have the flag and look like they're doing it for all the right reasons. And that's the scary part, because it's just a flag. You know, Minnesota just changed their flag. I'm still getting used to that. I'm not even sure what it means, but, you know, in the old flag, it looked like the farmer was getting ready to grab his gun while the Indian was running away on his horse. So this is a step up, you know. And that's patriotic too, right?
That's Frank Bebo. We'll hear more from him later in this hour, talking about his legal strategy to protect the rights of nature.
It was full of other people's little wars.
great for a spell like buffalo. Everything that's sicker. And to the dinner end, the business bickered. And they called for the three great stimulants of the exhausted ones. Out of this,
on our weekly mix of words and music, Stay Human. I'm Michael Goldberg. On this week's show, we're talking about sovereignty in honor of our country declaring itself to be sovereign, which is as good a reason as any for a three-day weekend. You can always use more of those. Me, I'm ready to go out anytime people want to get together for a picnic and a party and a celebration, maybe by the lake. You could bring forth a July celebration, and if you invite me, I will try to fit it into my busy schedule. Meat sizzling, sweet clouds of carcinogens floating through the air, and frisbees too. Music playing, kids running around jazzed on soda pop, the potluck of woodland kitchens. Everyone gives and is gifted. And don't forget the pie and fireworks. Maybe even some speechifying for the banners and the bunting. That can be okay if the speaker can bring us with them. I have not been invited to make any Independence Day speeches, but I like to be ready just in case. So I read that thing that Thomas Jefferson wrote and realized it would not work, not even with the most James Earl Jones tones. No, it wouldn't work to read it out loud to a crowd. For one thing, it would take 9 or 10 minutes of gorgeously complex sentences with a list of crucial subjunctive clauses. I mean, way too much for the attention span of a modern human. You could do all right with the part in the beginning, the truths that are called self-evident, which means you can't prove one way or the other that all men are created equal. It's something you either believe or you don't. Or in the case of the men who signed the thing, many of them slaveholders, it's something that you believe and you don't. But once you get past that part and the affirmations of self-governance, you'd have to read through the 27 specific charges against the sovereign King George. Things like, quote, he has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers, and so on. By the time you're reading that part, the teenagers have all snuck off and everybody's checking their phones. Better by far to briefly summarize it. After the president had a copy of the Declaration hung on a wall of the Oval Office, a reporter asked, "What does the Declaration of Independence mean to you?" He replied, "Well, it means exactly what it says. It's a declaration of unity and love and respect. And it means a lot. And it's something very special to our country." Nobody's going to be reading out the Declaration on any 4th of July celebrations. And anyway, it's not enough just to declare it. You got to publish it, too. As in, by authority of the good people of the colonies, we solemnly publish and declare. So said those traitors to the king. Publishing, making it truly public can be a tricky thing. And of course, it was a lot harder back then. They got it to the printer on the 5th of July, a Friday, and he proceeded to make a run of broadsides, a few dozen of them, one at a time, of course. A couple of weeks later, Congress ordered a new edition printed on parchment, and it wasn't until the 2nd of August that John Hancock affixed his bold signature. So, don't worry about it if you don't get to celebrate on the 4th of July. Next month, we can have a Signature Day celebration. That ought to be good for another 3 or 4 day weekend. Or maybe we should be open 7 days a week but only work a 4 day shift, like at Costco. Actually, I'm applying for dual citizenship. I could never give up being an American, but would also like to be a citizen of Kirkland. I'm already loyal, wearing the Kirkland brand on my underwear, grinding the Kirkland coffee beans every morning. Kirkland, I imagine, must be a place of tremendous climate variety and endless productivity. Just walk among the towering shelves of any Costco, and you've got to agree, their abundance is self-evident. As a citizen of Kirkland, I'll have the right to move into one of the senior citizen one-bedroom apartments they're bound to build before too long, build them inside a park that would buffer us from the parking lot. And then anytime I feel like it, I'll be able to wander over to the store, try a few of the free samples, sit in one of those big lounge chairs and watch a giant flat-screen TV. And of course, I would exercise my civic duty by helping visitors find where the restrooms are or the office supply section, the candy, whatever they need. I pledge my allegiance. Oh, Kirkland, I hear your bounty call. Abundance and low overhead, you feed and clothe us all. I'll let you know when my citizen papers come through, and, you know, everyone's welcome to visit. Bizet has his day, and you do too, here on KAXE KBXE, streaming at KAXE.org, telling the stories of the people and the land of northern Minnesota. Thanks to all the listeners whose membership contributions keep us on the air. Join us anytime at KAXE.org, or just text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks so much. This weekly hour of Story and Song receives additional support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. So far in this hour, we've talked about personal sovereignty, patriotism from an indigenous perspective, and the Declaration of Independence. Up next, Bemidji writer Marsh Muirhead establishes his own sovereign nation. Marsh Muirhead.
I was called to what became the Island Republic, a three-acre body of high ground in the Mississippi River, by its conspicuous wildness, the density and size of its trees, its green impenetrable depths, thick with ferns, birds of all kinds entering and exiting its dark interior. I had passed this island many times before, but when a for sale sign went up, I was seized with a vision, a living metaphor, an island in a stream, suggesting the barefoot, shirtless life of Huck Finn, the Neverland of Peter Pan. It was my version of a midlife crisis. Impractical, unaffordable, I bought it. It was November when friend and neighbor Will Weaver and I set out for the first exploratory mission. We crossed the milky ice, gained the island, and proceeded through dense undergrowth into the interior. Found open areas, perfect for tent sites. Animal tracks confirmed that wildlife was plentiful, beaver, deer, otters, that fuel for our campfires was abundant. We declared the island an independent nation, fit for settlement, and assumed titles with only ceremonial powers. Myself, generalissimo and benevolent dictator. My companion, Brigadier General Will Weaver. We decreed a ban on any infrastructure or weapons, respecting the flora and fauna, allowing no cutting of live trees. Several exploratory missions were made throughout the winter. A large open area surrounded by towering Norway was declared the cathedral and would become the central social center. We established a pathway around the isle using game trails, clearing deadfall. Our missions ceased for a few weeks in the spring when the ice became unsafe for crossing, then resumed in May via watercraft. An open immigration policy was announced, and it was remarkably easy to recruit friends and relatives as citizens, falling into step without coaxing or explanation. We declared June 21st, the solstice, our national holiday, hosting new immigrants and their dogs for celebration. Citizenship was granted to all. Titles by assignment are good deeds, fire building, plant identification. Susan Hauser, Minnesota Book Award winner, was obvious choice for our poet laureate. My mother, Jean Elizabeth, was pleased to wear a crown of leaves as the queen mother. Others filled the positions of adjutant general, harbor master, ambassadors to and from other island nations. We were lunatics, lovers, and poets of imagination all compact, and gave our local habitation a name, the Island Republic. The summer solstice became an annual affair and the most robust. Other observances were the winter solstice, equinoxes, all full moons. Random impromptu celebrations were frequent and for any reason, observing that if you pay attention, each day is a different season. The unfurling of fiddlehead ferns, the first peepers in May, the appearance of fireflies in June, cicadas in late July, a perpetual circus, aerialists, swimmers, songsters, bounders and bloomers, a symphony of constant change punctuated by the unexpected. Scores of pelicans arriving one spring, devouring the fingerlings in the waters offshore. A bear swimming across the river. The one-time sprouting of a morel mushroom near our fire circle. The administration of the Island Republic required attending to practical matters. Our ban on infrastructure was modified to allow the construction of a modest dock on the eastern shore to allow for small boats and access for our aged citizens with mobility issues. Thus, the dock of the infirm was much appreciated by the Queen Mother. Comfort stations needed to be environmentally friendly and offer privacy, and so deep in the bushy sector, we created a kind of outhouse without walls, a comfortable box with a toilet seat and lid. The facility produced little or no odor, and visitors enjoyed the contemplative setting and privacy while completing their business. Naturally, we established an Island Republic library specializing in river themes and island nests, a waterproof storage box where you could find a river runs through it, islands in the stream, Treasure Island, a copy of Shakespeare's The Tempest, travel guides to Cuba and the Galapagos. As literary citizens, we launched the Island Journal, soliciting fiction, poetry, photography, and artwork from our citizens. Submissions ranged from watercolor interpretations by young children to original work by our own people, as well as that we solicited from near and far. Poetry from Lisa Starr of Block Island and poems by Reef Perkins of Key West. One summer, a group of teachers of English from Iceland on tour in the Midwest were visiting Bemidji. Asked if they would like to visit our island nation, the Icelandics assumed the role. They secured a watercraft and set off across the water, their flag held high in the bow, singing their anthem in their native tongue. Our visitors were given a quick tour of the perimeter before settling in at the cathedral and led toasts for all with their national beverage, Brennivín, a kind of gin made from Icelandic water with hints of caraway seed. They inquired about our customs and laws. Can we pee in the woods, they asked? Yes. Can we smoke? Yes. Can we swim? Yes. Can we swim naked? Of course. All such queries were answered in the affirmative, after which they suggested a motto for our country, Alt erlaubt, everything is permitted. The motto was adopted with none opposed. The Brennivín and our own domestic beverages took us late into the night around the fire, joining in song in both of our languages. Some of the best times were when I went to the island alone. I'd pack a cooler of food and paddle or motor down, just me and the golden retriever, Scout. The plan might have been an evening in front of a fire or an overnight, but a few times I stayed for a few days without a plan, feeling most connected with the unspoken, inhaling the woody fecundity of the forest floor, watching and listening to a V of migrating geese. Late at night, I'd look up through the tall evergreens, their points piercing the star-sprinkled indigo sky, feeling as though they were sentries, feeling a kind of intoxication with being there and then, just that. This is how we lived and celebrated our days and nights, silly and sincere, a mix of reality and fantasy. Our chief business was the curative balm of communication and communion with this small wild place, the lessons and observations taken with notes and photos, summed up by lines from a poem Todd Boss contributed to our journal. The nervous birds, the toads forever lost on mud's malleable maps, everything's a mess and genius all at once, a school for unruliness, even the stones second-guess themselves, eroding, and there, a wash of sunshine and some people boating. In the fifth year of our republic, the magic began to fade. Significant realities broke the spell. Firewood remained plentiful, but the task of its harvest became more difficult as much of it was deep in the thickets. Moving the comfort station was not a pleasant chore and fell to the benevolent dictator. The winter crossings became impossible when no trespassing signs were posted along the road at our entry point. Due to our frequent habitations, the island was seen to have some value beyond its forested and boggy beauty, and so the levy imposed by the United States quadrupled by the fifth year of independence. Many of our younger citizens, older ones too, felt disadvantaged without Wi-Fi. Several severe thunderstorms came through in the final years of our occupancy. The wind and rain brought down many of our greatest trees. It was sad to see the immense root ball of some of these overturned trees, revealing the incredible communication network, this root disc, its edge a mass of frayed broken ends looking like the complicated wiring of a giant appliance, connecting the morel to the white pine. Trails were blocked, camping areas crisscrossed with thick trunks of 100-year-old Norways. The rising water level of the river exacerbated the problem. Part of the shoreline eroded away, and the eastern point of the island, 200-foot tongue of land, brushy with a few small birches, washed away completely, taken over by the river. And so I sold the island for about what I paid for it. Although the idea of ownership is an illusion, the island is owned by time and the river. But the Island Republic and our time there remain in the imaginations of our citizens, and we regard ourselves as expatriates. In the last issue of the Island Journal, I wrote, paraphrasing the British Isles ambassador to the Island Republic, Michael Thomas, a remembrance of our gatherings, our many times together. And over there, in a circle of chairs, see our little group gathered around the fire. The sweet smoke wafts upward through the boughs and the trees to the mines of heaven, the hole where the moon sits, dripping stars that wake once again to their luck of light and distance.
Thanks to Marsh Muirhead. That piece was excerpted from the version published by the Whitefish Review in its 2025 issue. Island dwellers, I think, tend to be more intentional about the way they live. Here's something from another island dweller, Taj Mahal, and the Hula Blues Band, recorded live in Kauai with the new Hula Blues.
Sit down on the beach, you can call me on my cell phone, but I'm gonna be out of reach, old Todd. Kick off your shoes. Oh, stand up in front of me, honey. Give me the new Hula Blues. I've fishing on the ocean, fishing in the sea. I got all the kawa-kawa swimming after me. Oh, dog, what you gonna do? Honey, slice me some sashimi. Give me the new hula blue. I said I'm hanging out at Barretto's. Show Sean none too. Music sounding sweeter than it ever did for me. You, baby, love you like I do. Give me the big loamy, loamy. Give me the new hula blue. I'm fishing on the ocean. Hula, hula too. Me and Captain Dave catching them big bad, 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 bad blue. Blue morning to you. Oh, stand up in front of me. Give me the new hula blue. Oh, my bahini bending over. Nice okole too. Ooh, 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 ooh. Love you like I do. Oh, stand up in front of me and give me the new hula blue. Bobby, everybody back it.
Exploration of Sovereignty and Who Has It. This from Frank Bebo, who we heard from at the beginning of this hour. Frank is a member of the Leech Lake Band and has lived most of his adult life on Leech Lake Reservation. He worked for many years as a reporter for Ojibwe News, that's how I first met him, and then he became an attorney with Anishinaabe Legal Services. He's executive director of the 1855 Treaty Authority and has worked as a tribal attorney for Leech Lake, White Earth, and several native-run organizations. He thought he was going to retire a few years back, but now he's working with tribes around the nation and with law schools to explain tribal law and discuss the rights of nature. Frank Bebo.
You know, you got to know what your rights are to exercise them and defend them. It seems, for whatever reason, people like to hear me talk about rights of nature, maybe because of my experiential background, you know, tribal connection, things like that. To me, it's an opportunity to have offensive law for tribal members to protect their resources. That's really what it comes down to. In the big sense of law, and these are things they don't teach you in law school, you know. They teach you like there's two forms of law, state and federal. Well, there's a whole bunch of Indians and we all got courts. So there's like 500 forms of law maybe going on. And so what I've learned through practicing law, not taught in law school, is that there are fictions of law. And there's a lot of fictions of law, and that fictions of law are just fine. And if fictions of law are just fine, just like a corporation is a person, well, then rights of nature isn't really that far off. If not, it's maybe inside of that, because all of those figments are alive. So why wouldn't they have more rights than a dead old piece of paper corporation? So we're inside of that fence in that sense. Now, from the Chippewa or Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, however you like to call us, I use the word Chippewa a lot because that's what our treaties use for the word, to identify us. If you look at our cultural beginnings, we came to Earth and petitioned the Creator. We came as wisps of smoke, or like spirits, and we came to this Earth and we wanted to live here. And we knew that we wanted to essentially, I'll use the word we would use against others, exploit all the resources so we could be live corporal beings. And obviously we're humans, so you know that we're gonna, you know, wanna do that. And so the Creator talked to all of creation. They said, okay, we can do that, but the Chippewa, those people always need to remember us in their ceremonies and the things that they do in life and who we are, and watch out for us because we're all related. And so that's the start point for us with nature. And then you go to wild rice. Wild rice, you know, you hear different stories, but it talks about our migrations to where the food grew on the water. Well, that was to here. That was to Lake Superior. It was to Michigan. It was to all over in northern Minnesota. So when you think about that, cultural migration through the spirituality of wild rice and coming here, and then from a legal standpoint, again, with treaties being supreme law of the land, we saw wild rice is so significant that the 1837 treaty talks about the when we're ceding territory, we're retaining the rights to hunt, fish, and gather wild rice on the lakes, rivers, and lands that we're ceding, which means we ain't moving. And the United States knew that at that point in time that we didn't plan to move. There weren't even reservations included in that treaty because we didn't need reservations because we were using it all. You know, it was other entities that wanted us on reservations and to reduce our footprint in different ways. So when you look at rights of nature, we've had thousands of years to connect and figure out what's going on and where our place is in nature, and we're not at the top. But for wild rice, when I was doing rights of nature, wild rice was in the treaties. You know, the treaties are the supreme law of the land. You know, so when you're looking at this, and this was really one of the first rights of nature litigations using tribal law and tribal court, and really the first time a plant, along with other plaintiffs, has sued someone else, and in our case, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And so that tool, it's a disruption tool. It's a disruption law. It takes it out of state law, it takes it out of federal law, and it puts it into our ballpark, using our laws the way we would want the case to proceed in terms of what information needs to be included to make a record. And what Minnesota found out was that their sovereignty wasn't a bar to what I was doing. And I can guarantee you they were very, very surprised because I'd never been sued openly like that in tribal court using tribal law. In fact, probably nobody had been at that point. And so ultimately we ended up at the Federal District Court in Minnesota down in St. Paul. And the DNR, they didn't like being in tribal court, and they were trying to get the federal court to step in, the judge, and stop it. And so we're in court, and it's during COVID time, and the DNR attorney essentially is telling the judge, you know, Your Honor, I need you to tell the Indians they can't use their law and their court against us. We're sovereign, you know? And the judge turns to that DNR attorney and says, can you point any law to me that I can see that gives me the authority to tell them no? And that's when I knew it was over, because I couldn't find any either. It's hard to understand the absence of information and what it does and doesn't mean, but I couldn't find out where they could do it, you know, because I'm operating under federal law. So Minnesota had no idea. Now, we weren't as lucky in our tribal court of appeals, but another good friend of mine out in Washington State by Seattle with the Sauk Seattle tribe, he saw what we were doing, and he was probably, I'll say, 6 weeks behind. He saw that Manomans sued the state DNR, and so the salmon out there sued the city of Seattle Power and Light in tribal court also. Same concepts. And so while we had some different things happening to us, the federal government, well, in this case, the state government, is predictable, and they went to federal court also. And they said, hey, we want you to tell those Indians they can't use their tribal law in tribal court against us. And that court also basically said, it doesn't matter how frivolous that law looks to you. They have a right to have their own law and decide whether or not you're subject to it in the jurisdiction. That probably alarmed 48 other states. You know, you don't hear about it too much, but all of a sudden things kind of changed. And within, I would say, 6 months, maybe a little longer, they came to what I would describe as a consent decree, because the City of Power and Light was in a FERC proceeding, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they were trying to get renewal permits for their dams, and they got three on the Skagit River that prevent the salmon from getting to the Sauk Seattle tribe, who have a treaty right to that. And FERC said, so, Seattle, what are we going to do about this? And, you know, they came up with some fish passageways and worked things out. So there is power. And it's mostly environmental protection because of our treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather in perpetuity. And so I've just changed the place and the way the mechanisms work. And we've gotten away from the crap that all the other courts have that interfere with what we want to do. The way Seattle worked out with the salmon, you know, showed that it was the right mechanism, that it is the right tool. So now the real part about it isn't so much the wild rice. Wild rice was very useful for me because all the Ojibwe already know what the wild rice story is. In fact, one of my legal friends, who's a professor, he wrote a law review on the jurisdiction on and off reservation about wild rice, because as soon as Chippewa hear the concept, it's just so logical. And so even when we went to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals with this issue, eight other Chippewa tribes from around here did an amicus brief because they could see what I was arguing was their rights too. And I was using it in a way that went around the federal government and the state government and you know, really showed the power of our rights. So it's just a matter of transitioning away at times, not all the time, but at particular times when it's important and you need to get in control of your own destiny, which is usually your own environment. I think, at least for the Chippewa, with what was done here with Manoman and what was certainly done with the Sauk Seattle and the salmon, if we have to do that a handful of more times in other states and locations, and the federal court says, look, Indians have rights. They have a right to have a tribal court, have their own laws, and, you know, you're messing with their stuff, and they've described it, you have to go back to their court. You're going to re-level the playing field for environmental degradation, to where if you know that you're going to be anywhere near close to Indians and impacting their rights, then you're going to be checking with the Indians maybe first, instead of last, or if at all. I think it's really going to change the way environmental projects are proposed. And that's really the most important part. They say that Enbridge, even because of other reasons as well, probably won't propose another pipeline here in the United States. And it took 9 years on a 6 month and 9 month process that the state had put together. So that was just our first try. You know, so things are going to change, and it's going to take those dynamics. You know, my friends who I work with the Center for Democratic Environmental Rights, they've been doing this for 20 years. But they've been doing it in a non-Indian environment. They've been doing it, you know, in laws that are subservient to the state laws, you know, trying to do it with communities and different things and all. And that's bravery to me, because that's hard. I already know why I don't work with the state, you know. And that's why when I looked at what they were doing, it was like, well, hey, I can see how to use these a little bit differently. And it really worked out well between us, because they needed to see a place for those laws. You know, what they had put together work and work in a good way. And I needed some other tools for what I was trying to do. So we've been working together for, I don't want to say a decade, but it's pretty close, you know. And other tribes, you know, they really like to see that there is something you can do.
That's Frank Bebo. If you'd like to learn more about advocating for the rights of nature and for the human right to a healthy environment, check out the Center for Democratic Environmental Rights. Their website is Center for Environmental Rights.
I'm not your Indian anymore. You belong to white man. that word of ours.
Floyd Crowe Westerman with BIA. Thanks for tuning in today, and thanks to Frank Bebo and Marsh Muirhead. I'm Michael Goldberg, back this time again next week for Spirit and Courage on Stay Human. We'll go out with this from Atmosphere.
Impatiently waiting for that American dream, staring at the cracked screen of my anti-fax machine. Crash landed where the woke intersect with the exhausted. They asked if I'm depressed, I don't doubt it. I was told it all began as a quest for some knowledge. Progress, after you process the conflict, I'll be okay. And if I got one wish, I'd probably waste it trying to make myself an optimist. It's ironic because most of my thoughts are positive. Just hop in the whip, I promise not to drive off of the cliff. Happiness is my favorite physical feature, but I'm afraid I'll figure out that it's a mythical creature. I need to believe in a simulation that we living in. Spent the whole stimulus, check on some stimulants, I'll be okay. Just freestyle the answers, if you feel it, put your hands up in front of surveillance cameras, okay? I don't take the buffet for granted, make you understand it when you see me licking my plate. We gotta travel through space to keep the family safe. Check your connections, can they handle the bass? If they reflect your face, it amplifies the existence of your significance, but only if you survive the collision. It'll be okay, even if you're feeling like there ain't no way. You're still with us today, it's gonna be okay. Okay. Alright, it'll be okay. Even if you're feeling like there ain't no way. You're still with us today, it's gonna be okay. Okay. I think I'm feeling alright, and I'll admit that sometimes I'm probably tongue-tied. Got me staring at the sun like my shoes ain't come untied. The clown face got replaced by this mountain of the Midwest average from the mid-2000s, huh? And being the best was never the intended destination. I just want appreciation for my presentation. Even if I was the only human left in population, this is dedicated to the dedication. You better love yourself today, cause tomorrow'll be harder. Put your guard up, don't let them penetrate your armor. Collect whatever crumbs you got and keep them in a bread box. You knew I was the one when I was sleeping in the wet spot. And maybe if you had a dollar for all of your doubters, maybe you could grow a salad and water the flowers. I know the zookeeper seen my leash and my collar. I'm in a tuxedo smoking weed in the shower. It'll be okay,
even if you're feeling like there ain't no way, you're still with us today. It's gonna be okay, okay. Alright, it'll be okay. Even if you're feeling like there ain't no way, you're still with us today. It's gonna